We are back with the Mystical Positivist. You're listening to Cal's Radio, KOWS LP, 107.3 FM from Occidental, California, community radio for West Sonoma County, streaming live on the World Wide Web at www.kows.fm. Right now it's time for a public service announcement. Come reimage civilization in the age of nature at the internationally acclaimed Bioneers Conference at the Marin Center in San Rafael this weekend, October 14th through 16th. Experience Gloria Steinem, Paul Stamets, Amory Lovins, Philip Cousteau, and many more. Connect with the dynamic Pioneers community and breakthrough solutions for people and planet. You can register at bioneers.org for the remainder of the conference or call 877-246-6337. Cal's Community Radio is generously supported by a number of underwriters. We'd like to thank Minnie Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Minnie Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Minnie Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware, and they also host spiritual talks and classes. Minnie Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street, Suite 101 in Sebastopol. You can reach them at area code 707-829-8871, email at info@miniriversbooks.com, or visit their website at www.miniriversbooks.com. That's M-A-N-Y, riversbooks.com. All right, you are listening to The Mystical Positivist, and our guest on today's discussion is Dr. Peter Davis. Dr. Peter Davis has been motivating others to reach their highest achievements since his early 20s. He teaches that humans can awaken their full powers for good and evolve themselves intentionally and consciously. He is the founder of the science of energy field psychology. Davis began his career as a group organizer, artist, and teacher at the Free University of Berkeley in Berkeley, California. He subsequently studied Tai Chi Chuan in the Chinese internal system, principally with Grandmaster T.R. Chung and Master Xu Guo Ming, as well as with Wang Hao Dao, Ye Xiao Long, and Qin Zhao Hong, all acknowledged Grandmasters. Peter was also deeply inspired by the work of several esoteric traditions, including the work of the dances of G.I. Gurdjieff, the Vedantic Yogic Masters, and Tibetan Buddhism. He traveled widely in search of and found authentic representations of these and other great traditions. He has been a devoted practitioner of meditation and kindred thoughts for decades. Dr. Davis is a natural synthesizer of many sciences, philosophies, disciplines, and therapeutic methods from which he distills his own unique teachings. So welcome back, Dr. Peter Davis. It's been a great conversation so far, so let us continue. I got your sound level up now.
Okay.
So, before the break, we were talking about Tai Chi Chuan as a spiritual practice, and we were discussing the necessity for bringing a three-centered sensibility into that practice. And I want to take a step back and talk about the spiritual practice, the spiritual path in general, and just get your sense of how you see or how you define the spiritual path. You know, for someone who, as we discussed earlier before the show, has this burning question in life of, is that all there is? And is trying to make sense of their being on this planet. A spiritual path is something that can be a great resource. So how do you define the spiritual path? And we'll take that from there.
Wow. Defining the spiritual path, well, in a sense, it's reflexive. Often in a young person, that person is shocked by what they see in the world, maybe through a traumatic family event or personal event. And to them, it's, how am I going to live this life with what's going on here? And then, with good fortune, the question comes, is this all there is? There must be something more than this. There must be something good and beautiful here. And somehow the spirit leaps forth in that moment, and the person begins to go in search of the miraculous. What can I find here? And then there's always in life so much chatter from the mind, which has been installed in us by our parents and society and history and so on, and so much chatter from the noisy cars and the noisy television and the media and da-da-da-da. Inside of us and all around us is the spirit that ignores that illumines our life and gives us the courage and the fight and the strength and the heartfulness to persevere, to make for ourselves and those close to us the best life that we can. And that may take the form of having a spiritual teacher, and a spiritual teacher, a guide, a mentor can be essential. It may take the form of having a sangha or a group with whom we can share that, and that can be essential also. And yet the path, the spiritual life, always comes back to what am I as an individual willing to give to it? How am I willing to live each day, each hour, each minute? And so it's a choice of conscience in each man or woman on the path.
It's an interesting notion you introduced there of what one is giving to the path, because so much of the metaphors that we are imprinted with in our current society, certainly Western society, is one of taking from. Like I go to the university and there's a transaction. I pay money, but I'm taking something. I'm getting something for myself that's a benefit for myself.
That even gets translated into the area of prayer, which is a word you used in the first half of the show, where most prayer is understood to be supplicative, in the sense that we ask God or a deity or whatever, a bodhisattva, for something for me, as opposed to offering something oneself.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get your sense on what it means to give back to the path.
Well, I'm aware of giving gifts. I'm aware of receiving gifts. And when someone asks me, I might say to them, life is the gift that we're given. Perhaps it's the gift, the only gift. That is, we're given aliveness. And so from our aliveness flows anything that we might give. It's not a question of owing because there's some kind of original sin or deficit. It's rather to become a fountain of youth, to become that which forgives, that which gives, that which benefits. And that for me is prayer, bodily prayer. In fact, I learned a prayer in Egypt a long time ago called the Akhenaten prayer, which I taught for years and years to my students, and it's very, very beautiful. In fact, we didn't have the music, so our pianist would play some of the Hartman Gurdjieff music to it. I think the prayer of the Assyrian mourning women. I forgot exactly how to say it. So we are the beings who can issue forth the blessing, the kindness that we seek. There's a prayer, I called it the prayer of St. Francis, and it was in my institute for years and outside my bedroom for years, and it has, ask not what someone else can do for you, but what you can do for them. Ask not to be understood, but seek to understand. Ask not to be loved, but seek to love, etc. And remember that when we love, the love has to pass all the way through us, through all our tissue. And so we are loved in the act of loving, you see. So that's the real life prayer, the bodily prayer.
Thank you. So in a sense, then, the embodiment of the teaching,
yes,
the embodiment and the becoming a source of the teaching is the giving back.
Yes.
That's how we give back to the path, is that we...
The giving back and the giving forward, in that it reconstructs the path.
Yeah. So it's actually a flow, then, is what you're talking about. It's not just I mean, clearly it's unidirect. It's not unidirectional. You've made that clear. But then that implies, of course, that you have a continuous flow of energy happening.
Yes. A continuous flow of energy, yes. Like the circulation of blood, the circulation of the atmosphere, yes.
Right. So what are some of the pitfalls you see for people engaging with a spiritual path? Before the show, we were speaking about some of these. I'll mention the idea that sometimes within a tradition, the language can be very specific, and people can relate to the language more than they relate to the actual meaning of the tradition.
Well, one great pitfall is to become chauvinistic about one's own path and to say, my path is the only true path or only true religion. And to use a very esoteric language that doesn't honor other languages.
Got it. So the sense here is that one can get trapped in the language, but ideally, if a path is a living path, it breathes beyond the confines of its conceptual structure.
Very much so.
But we have a question from a listener who's calling in, so
sure.
I will put the listener on the radio. Hold on. Hello, you are on the air.
Hi. I was intrigued by the comments about, forgiving or contributing to the spiritual path. And I was wondering how you would suggest someone, contribute or give in that way if they're feeling hurt, if they don't feel they feel stuck in victimization type of stance.
Well, so many of us have felt the victim. In fact, we all have. And our heart hurts. And one of the first things that I've done as a therapist or a teacher is ask the person to let themselves weep, let themselves cry. It's often harder in men than in women to just let it flow through the heart. And we often can't forgive all at once. Sometimes the damage is too much. We feel brutalized. And sometimes for a moment we can stand aside from our own hurt and we can recognize that whoever brutalized us or hurt us, they were in a great deal of pain and probably still are. And maybe we can have a tiny good wish for them. And perhaps someday, the thought comes, when I've healed from this, I could have a good thought for this person, a good wish for them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I've been really interested in Wilhelm Reich, W.R., Mysteries of the Organism, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And so I don't really have a specific question formulated. I was just interested in hearing more about that or how that kind of healing works. It just looks like, people writhing, like a whole room of people writhing around in their underwear. And so I don't know if you could...
The diaper crew, the underwear crew.
What?
To say a couple of things, Wilhelm Reich discovered what he called orgone energy, a universal energy, which I'm completely convinced as a physicist has been discovered many times and has been discovered by the big accelerator in CERN now, but was been discovered repeatedly. In any case, this orgone energy he called the life energy, it flows through us. So the job of the orgone therapist or bioenergetic therapist is to help the human being and human body release the unnecessary tension in the body and in the emotional life. He called it neuromuscular armoring, and it is truly a neuromuscular freezing in the entire system of the three centers. so that through better breathing, emotional release, good contact with a therapist, with a good contact with one's own inner life, one gradually can dissolve some of this armoring, and this orgone or life energy can flow through the body, heart, and mind and heal the human being and connect us with nature and other human beings. That's basically Wilhelm Reich in a nutshell.
Great. Cool.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. Bye-bye.
So it was with Dr. Philip Kukurutu that you, I probably got that name wrong, that you delved into the Reich material. Is that correct?
Well, I was a student of Freud and studying psychology seriously, and then I had several therapists, both for training and also for therapy, who were part of the tradition that Freud, but particularly Reich, developed. However, Dr. Kukurutu, who was trained by Alan Cott, who was trained directly by Reich, was the most consistent and skilled. He was the one who could evoke this tremendous flow of energy, not from any mystical reason, and I mean mystical in the kind of pejorative way, you know, like believe in this energy. No, it wasn't that. He was a very disciplined clinician, and he would simply keep the patient or pupil on track to get this energy to flow in the body.
So, I was familiar with his name because actually in 1978, I and my teacher established a bookstore right here in downtown Occidental. Looked very different at the time, downtown Occidental did, of course, in 1978, called the Secret Sufi Bookstore. And we were rented this space for that bookstore by a guy named Al Bernard, who had worked with Dr. Kukurutu. Uh-huh. So that's how I know him.
I see.
But I never met him myself.
Yeah. Quite a guy.
Well, along those lines, one of your many books is called One Leg Dancing Master,
yes,
which is about your combination of your psychotherapeutic knowledge and clinical experience along with the work of a spiritual life and a,
yes,
spiritual practice. So I'm interested because this is definitely a trend I have seen in particularly in Northern California. We see it with the people who come through many rivers, which is what I would call the psychologicalization of the spiritual path.
Mm.
So I'm interested in your view of the relationship between the therapeutic model and the spiritual model, you know, the where you find they work together and support each other and where you find that they may have different ends ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my teachers, Dr. Malcolm Brown, who lives in Corfu, Greece now. Hi, Malcolm. He said, you'll either be a guru or a psychotherapist, but not both. And it turned out I became both, principally because I realized that my patients or clients needed a group experience. They needed other people who were going through the kinds of things they were, the kind of transformative experiences, especially those involved in Reich's therapy, because it really changes a human being. And so the difficulty in the therapeutic experience is to become too embroiled with the dark, traumatic past and to pathologize one's own experience too much. It becomes too dense and dark. The difficulty with the spiritual experience is to make it too flowery. And, you know, the guru and God are one, and he gives me Shaktipat, and then all I need to do is sit there, and I'll be healed of all ills, and I'll become enlightened. And, you know, please forgive me. I don't mean to insult any psychotherapists, because I have been one, or any spiritual path or teaching teacher, because I've done that too. But rather to look for the synthesis and the reconciliation or harmony on the path that allows one to, in a sense, to begin remembering the beauty and wonder of one's past, perhaps even the beauty and wonder of one's future, and also to recognize that the spiritual path requires becoming a tiger, eventually a dragon, as the Taoist masters would say. We're not going to, at least in my experience, become the awakened, vibrating bodhisattva we wish to be if we're only a lamb. We need to be a lion also, or a wolf also. That is, we need to embody, as we say, both the yin and yang, or both sides of our nature. So it's going to be quite a struggle. And my point of view is that therapy is essential when we live in a world such as we do. Not a particular kind, necessarily. Oh, I happen to like Reich's therapy. And that a spiritual path is also essential in the world in which we live. They are both essential as walking and breathing and sleeping and eating.
So this is an interesting question, and it's one that I've been looking at myself for a long time, because, you know, I have had friends having different perspectives on this question, and they can be quite articulate about opposing positions. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to sort of tease this apart a little bit further. One of the things, as you were speaking, that came up to me was the recollection that in the Buddhist suttas, one of the things, as I've read them over a period of years, and one of the things that just kept coming up again and again in sutta after sutta was that the Buddha recommends that you hang out with people who are interested in the same things that you're interested in, and not in people who are interested in other things. In a way, that's kind of like the definition of sangha. And I'm wondering if, at least in the Buddha's time, that wouldn't have taken the place of what you are recommending psychotherapy do for people on a spiritual path. Because I can grasp, given the immensity of the immense inertia of the egoic creation, as you used an interesting word for it. I'm trying to remember the exact word you used. If your parents, God, it wasn't insert, but it was something along those lines. Install, that was it. The parent installs a kind of programming in the child, and I love the. It's a unique use of the word for me, and I enjoy it because, of course, we install these days apps or software, and here's something very, very analogous. So I'm curious about your take on this issue of whether it is more or less in line with what I think I heard you say, that it's the particular challenges of our circumstances today that lead you to recommend the pairing of psychotherapy with spiritual practice, or whether there could be ways in which practice itself could offer the same things that psychotherapy now is of whatever kind is able to give people.
Well, let's suppose we take away the word psychotherapy or take away the word spiritual practice, mm-hmm. and we dissolve that into we can be alone, we can be in a group, or we can be face on face with another human individual. And we require those three experiences for our evolution, whether mm-hmm. we call it therapy or spiritual practice. So in that, the Sangha is essential. That is, we're with our community of beings who intend themselves forward in a similar fashion as do we. Mm-hmm. We also need a face-to-face confrontation with someone who will not be moved, and we need them to be benevolent towards us also. Mm-hmm. And by not be moved, I mean we can't, I don't know if I can use the word, but we can't bullshit them. And they will confront us.
Or manipulate them.
We cannot manipulate them. Yeah, it's a very good word for that. And we need that confrontation, and then we need the confrontation with ourselves in private. How do I live when I'm alone, or presumably so? Or if one's religiously minded, how do I live with God when, quote, I'm alone but God is watching? And so those states of being with the group, with the confrontive and supportive individual, or alone, embody, contain both psychotherapy and the spiritual path.
Well, it's interesting that in certain traditions, like the Buddhist tradition has a notion of provisional teachings. In the Fourth Way tradition, there is a consideration that the self-analysis that one does to look at habit patterns that one may have, to identify one's chief feature and things like that, also represents a kind of provisional teaching as opposed to, say, self-observation itself, which is more of a soundless or nonverbal energetic process. And my sense is that psychological techniques are very similar to what constitutes many provisional teachings, but there's a certain something else that I guess it gets captured for me by the word of embodiment that I don't necessarily see in therapeutic systems that don't have a spiritual foundation or a spiritual intention built into them.
That's correct as I see it. That is, the distinction is that most therapeutic systems are based on the so-called Western medical model or a pathological model. In other words, the person undergoing therapy is sick and the doctor is not. That's a poor base to start from. A much better base is one where the person seeking help or guidance is to some degree healthy and some degree wealth, and they are actively seeking something more in life. And the doctor or therapist or teacher knows something about life, and they have a methodology, they have some training, mm-hmm. and they can bestow that and engage the pupil in that.
Yeah, sometimes when we've brought the same kind of topic up with other guests on our show from other traditions, that the common thread tends to be that in order to engage in spiritual work effectively, you have to have a healthy ego. It doesn't mean you, and a healthy ego means not a compulsively dominant ego, and not a wounded ego that is, leaks energy, and that the psychological or the therapeutic systems are really aimed at trying to bring the ego into a state of health. And so such guests have tended to take the opinion that the psychological or therapeutic side of things is intended to provide someone with the foundation they need to actually engage then in what we would call spiritual practice.
That's a good idea. However, I've found that many people, as we say, sometimes put the cart before the horse, and they're on this very involved, exotic spiritual path, but they haven't really done any self-observation, self-analysis, or work on themselves, and so they tend to get in terrible trouble. Remember that the spirit needs to be embodied. The spirit will come, the enlightenment will come, and when it does, the body has to take it. It has to be strong enough to take it. So this can be a mistake if we're not solid enough or don't have a formed enough ego.
Right. That the term that I think that's current these days in spiritual and spiritual psychological circles is the notion of spiritual bypass, which is basically describes when someone uses the refuge of a spiritual tradition to avoid doing work on themselves in a psychological sense.
Yeah. Well, I've certainly seen my share of that.
It's a big danger, and there are many ways to negotiate it. It seems to me, I guess one of the things that's interesting to me is the idea of Stuart mentioned a moment ago a distinction between a psychological or psychotherapeutic tradition that, and you talked about it as one as based on a pathologization of experience versus what Stuart called a therapeutic tradition that is rooted in some kind of spiritual understanding. And maybe that's a way to think about this. That is to say, if there's an understanding of what in some traditions would be called transcendence, then that can provide a context where the sort of I won't say remedial work, because everyone has to do remedial work of this kind in some fashion, one way or another, but that basic work can be supported.
Well, I again framing this in terms of the need for alone experience, solitary experience, face-to-face experience with other human beings that is honest, genuine, and experience in support of community, sangha, group, and so on, as all essential. I remember a pupil who came to me from the Gurdjieff tradition and another who came to me from the Ramana Maharshi tradition, and they were both sitting with me, and I pointed to the guy from the Gurdjieff, and I said, "You've been, so to speak, on the will path." The guy on the Ramana Maharshi path, "You've been on the grace path. You must come together to understand which comes next." And so in a sense, for me, the therapeutic path is a bit like the arduous training that can be part of the fourth way. The spiritual life is sometimes, perhaps not for us, but for many people, contextualized as just let go and let God, believe in Jesus Christ, all will be well. My experience is, as human beings, we must embody all of that. And so the spiritual life informs the therapeutic, or the inner human life, and the inner human life and therapeutic informs the spirit. I'm a human being who is also the spirit and embodies it. I'm a spirit who is embodied as a human being, something like that. So I've had just many patients, clients, and students who came from one tradition or another, and we're asking just this question. Is my path okay? Yes, your path is okay. Am I okay? Yes, you are just fine. Yes. And there's more?
Well, one area that I was interested in is part of your work, certainly would maybe be classed in the therapeutic side, is captured in your book, The Psychology of Personal Success, which has a flavor from the material, the review material I looked at, of the kind of positiveness and mm-hmm. a positive approach to life that is familiar in many of the power of positive thinking kinds sure. of modalities. And I guess the angle I'm interested in on this is, again, the relationship between the power of positive thinking and personal success and the spiritual path. And the way I frame that is sort of like the balance between the noumenal and the phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I guess I would put is that, does getting it necessarily translate to personal success? What is the mark, is it, to use a Buddhist term, of someone who has awakened? Are they driving a Mercedes or a Lexus, or are they ringing bells panhandling on the streets of San Francisco?
Or both.
Well, we have very many images of having made it. Personal success is always personally defined. And is it more successful to be a Wall Street billionaire with 4 quadruple bypasses and to have one's own helicopter and Learjet, but to be unhappy? And there may be Wall Street investment bankers who are perfectly healthy and perfectly happy, and maybe they live to be 300. These are all possibilities. So personal success is personally defined. How do I define it for myself? Well, I've existed at different levels of material wealth and different levels of spiritual wealth. For me, do I wake up in the morning happy to jump out of bed, or happy to lay there and meditate or just vegetate? Am I at peace with eating When I meet another human being, do I actually listen to them? When I find myself alone, do I enjoy the time with myself and with great nature? When I travel, do I bring my power with me, and do I become part of the culture into which I'm infused through my travel and become part of those people and their diet and their the air they breathe? So how big am I willing to be? And that's part of my measure of personal success. Am I able to heal myself, cure myself of ailments? Am I able to place myself in samadhi whenever I feel like it? Am I able to love? Am I able to forgive? So these are all challenges for me personally, which are part of my model of personal success. And so at one time in my life, I was much more materially wealthy than I am now. And to enjoy my life, I gave away my money and my time to the people I loved. What a wonderful thing to do. And now I'm embarking on a new profession that has nothing to do with anything people would believe about me and what I would choose to do with my time, as well as continuing my spiritual work and my teaching work. So personal success is defined by oneself.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very clear. Well, since we have only a few minutes left, I don't think a interview with you would be complete without some discussion of the physics side of things.
Okay.
You talk about the science of the energy field psychology, and one of your books is The Astonishing Physics of the Mind.
Ah, yes.
And so I'd like to, given my own background as a physicist, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the astonishing physics of the mind. And,
sure.
And maybe that'll be a good way to lead us to a close here.
Well, when I was a bit younger than I am today and I enjoyed studying all these things, I came across the idea of the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky thought experiment. And I won't try to explain that because it takes a little while. But anyway,
it takes a long time just to say the name of it.
John Bell, a theoretical physicist and mathematician, figured out that the thought experiment was at least incomplete. And a while later, Alain Aspect proved that, in fact, that was so. Alain Aspect was able to show the phenomenon of quantum entanglement. What the heck is that? Well, quantum entanglement basically says that whenever two little thingies are part of the same system, call them photons or electrons or whatever you like, even when we separate them out of that system and send them to different corners of the universe, they remain a unit. And if you spin one another direction in New York, the one in San Francisco instantaneously responds by spinning in an appropriate direction that matches the one that's spinning in New York. If you stop them and spin them in reverse directions, they match up again instantaneously, which violates special relativity or the velocity of light. In any case, recently I got to see Nassim Haramein in town here, or well, in Sebastopol, and I'd been studying his work for a little while. He and Elizabeth Rauscher have written equations called the Schwarzschild proton, which tell us essentially, this is very wild, that the mass density or vibratory density of the vacuum fluctuations inside a proton, and remember that the universe of things is made out of protons, is equivalent, that is 10 to the 55th grams per cubic centimeter. It's equivalent to the mass of the entire universe. Now, don't try to figure it out, but the fact that the numbers match and the fact that the Schwarzschild proton brings together gravity with a strong nuclear force and the color force tells us that it represents something about the whole universe of protons being entangled with itself, being an instantaneous communication with itself. Anyway, that's the astonishing physics of the mind, because we're made out of that stuff. That's amazing.
So when you say that we unwittingly practice mind power over matter every day, what's an example of that?
Well, it's so obvious once you see how it works. Every day we think about other people, and every day we can make ourselves feel happy or bad simply in how we think about the people in our lives. Right now, a woman who's very important to me up in Sacramento is dying from a brain tumor. I'm not there, but one of our ministers is there taking care of her and her children. And I'm not going up there. And yet the minister who's there with her is blessing her, holding her hand, looking in her eyes, and somehow Laura knows that I'm there with her because I said so and because I feel her being. And then I'm living with her, and I'm going through the process of dying with her. And that very much changes my biochemistry, changes my neurochemistry. It fills me with serotonin and endorphins and dopamine, even oxytocin experiences. Another oxytocin is equated with what you feel after an orgasm or with a nursing mother or something. In other words, it feels really good and cosmic and so forth. And so this is, for my heart, real prayer, real, you know, mind over matter. That is the body changing itself with the intention of awareness or intention of mind. And I have watched people in this town and others who were dying of some horrible form of cancer or some other ailment just get all better. I've seen 25 people in my life get all better, including myself, from some illness that doctors looked at them and said, you're finished, you're screwed. Not to belittle the doctors, they do what they can do. We need to become, as one of my friends says, miracle-minded. And by that, we recognize that the intention we have influences and changes often instantaneously our physical reality.
Got it. We've had as a guest on our program before Dr. Dean Radin from the IONS, or the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and he's done a lot of work in the area of trying to quantitatively show, under very pure double-blind experimental protocols in the lab, instances where intention that we set actually changes a physical system or changes a measurable outcomes of physical systems. Mm-hmm. And his research is very legitimate in this regard, although it's not widely embraced by the conventional scientific community because it's too far off the reservation of what normally gets funded. But his work I find very compelling along these lines, you know, that the mind somehow this notion of consciousness, when it focuses to embody an intention, can affect the matter around us.
Mm-hmm.
Which echoes traditions that speak about conscious eating, for instance, that we can put our intention into food before we eat it or as we're preparing it, and that will change the nature of the, to use a fourth way term, the hydrogens that are contained within that food. And in that way, it becomes a way of bootstrapping ourselves to mm-hmm. reinforcing a positive energetic state in ourselves.
Absolutely.
Well, we have time for a short question. Do you have one, Rob?
Well, it's I have to admit I'm not as well versed in physics as you are, Stuart. But I guess the question that comes to my mind is the practical end of this exploration of the ways in which consciousness interacts with materiality. And so during the break earlier, our guest was demonstrating the I forget what you call it, tai chi chuan touch practice, and I'm wondering what was occurring to me as I was watching that that two person practice occurring is what consciousness is being transferred between the bodies as they are in contact in this sort of dance-like form that you were engaged in. I don't know if there, you can say much about that in a very short space of time, but go for it.
I can. Ordinarily, when we touch, we may not realize it, but we either push the individual away or we recoil from them. And in Tai Chi Chuan, we learn to do neither. We learn to let our qi flow completely, and we call it Ting Jing, the ability to read the energy flow and the mind flow of the other person, starting with reading our own. And that allows us Tong Jing, which means to understand the other person. And so we neither push the person away, nor do we move away, but we fuse harmoniously our movement and our energy field with the other person, and we're practicing together. And if we're the teacher, then we can guide that person's energy flow as well as their physical structure. And so that's the direct application of mindfulness, or as we call it, Yi Qi, mind energy or intention energy, to the changes in the body. And very quickly, we can observe the changes in our own and in the pupil's body. For example, their body will relax. They'll let their shoulders down. They'll breathe out. Their eyes will brighten and so on. So it's a very beautiful application of the laws of physics to human psychology and biology and to changes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was very succinct.
Good.
Perfectly stated. Well, obviously the 2 hours have flown by. This has been a very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you.
Indeed.
We very much appreciate you coming here. So, Dr. Peter Davis, thank you for joining us on the Mystical Positivist.
Thanks, Stuart, and thank you, Rob. It's been very, very enjoyable.
Good.
All right. Well, we have a few station items to do before we close. Cal's Community Radio is generously supported by a number of underwriters, so we'd like to thank SolarWorks for their generous support. State rebates and tax credits reduce the cost of your photovoltaic system. For more information, go to solarworksca.com on the web. And we'd also like to make a plug for a very important event that's coming up. This is the Calzapalooza, which is a fundraiser for Cal's Public Radio. I'm going to play you a promo for it that one of our programmers made very creatively, so listen in.
No need to be scared. It's time for the first annual Cowsapalooza Halloween Ball. This family-friendly event is a benefit for Cows Community Radio in Occidental and will feature yummy local foods, treats and games, arts and crafts, and all sorts of music. The Jug Dealers, the Coast Pilots, Besa Negro, Samba Freestone and Fire Child. There will also be the Kali Shakti Belly Dancers and the Kalalea Fire Troop. Come dressed in your Halloween finery and enter the costume contest. That's Saturday night, October 29th at the Occidental YMCA, the first annual Cowsapalooza. Get your tickets at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. It all begins at 6 p.m. For more information, KOWS.FM.
Scary stuff. You can get the tickets for Cowsapalooza for sale at the Last Record Store in Santa Rosa, People's Music in Sebastopol, Hand Goods in Occidental, the Galleria at Occidental, or brownpapertickets.com. So, coming up on the Mystical Positivist, we are still scheduling our show for next week, but on October 29th, our guest will be Joko Dave Hazelwood. Joko Dave Hazelwood is a Soto Zen priest and guiding teacher of Empty Bowl Sangha in Cotati, California. A Dharma heir of Jisho Warner, Hazelwood is also an associate teacher at Warner's Stone Creek Zen Center. Additionally, Dave counts among his teachers Shunru Suzuki, Philip Whalen, and Jakusho Kwan. He is also a member of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association of North America. That is Saturday, October 29th on the Mystical Positivist. This week on the spiritual calendar at Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, The Caregiver Revolution, Five Easy Steps to Enlightened Caregiving, given by Patricia Elizabeth, author of The Caregiver Revolution. That will be Thursday, October 20th at 7:30 p.m. at Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol. For years, especially in Western culture, taking care of the elderly, the infirm, and the dying have been viewed in a negative light. Terms like caregiver burnout, burden, and strain have dominated the discussion. But now that has changed with The Caregiver Revolution, a book and movement that is dedicated to getting rid of the stress and transforming caregiving into a positive, life-affirming experience. The Caregiver Revolution infuses caring for others with enthusiasm and hope. The book provides simple tools and techniques for organizing the home environment, creating a care circle, reducing stress, and practicing here and now mindfulness in the midst of the hectic caregiving environment. Straightforward and practical methods are provided for dealing with crisis situations, including a section on how anyone can be gracefully present with someone who is dying. With a light and accessible tone, The Caregiver Revolution's practical information is supported by real-life anecdotes and whimsical illustrations. Patricia Elizabeth is a midwife and a terminal midwife. She has given workshops in the field of end-of-life care and death and dying for more than 30 years. She is a cancer survivor of 5 years and lives in Grass Valley, California. Patricia Elizabeth has also been a guest on The Mystical Positivist. You can check out her show on The Mystical Positivist radio show number 11 at from February 26th of 2011 this year. I'll give you the website in just a moment. I'd like to read another underwriter announcement. Cal's Community Radio thanks Occidental Nutrition for its generous support. Occidental Nutrition specializes in holistic nutrition support for treatment of diabetes, allergies, and other ailments. They have a specialty in oncology massage and nutritional support for cancer patients. For information, call area code 707-508-5377 or go to www.occidentalnutrition.com. All right. Well, thank you for joining us once again for The Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. And please send comments, feedback, and associated questions to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Please join us again here next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hop, so stay tuned. Until then, I'm going to give you another musical interlude from Silk Road Journeys, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. This is track 11, Filipino Azulolo. And so we'll see you next week.